Hello, welcome to episode number 37 of the At YouTube podcast, talking all things YouTube, including new album news, which we actually have some tour dates, which we kind of don't have, and community discussions from the staff of At YouTube. Joining me for this episode, we're talking war, and I have three very excellent, let's say, shall we call them war correspondents? Is that appropriate?
I love it.
We have Becky coming back to the podcast. Welcome back, Becky.
Thank you.
Great to have you back. And to Sula, you're coming back again.
Yep, glad to be here.
Glad to have you. And Marilyn is back. Well, back officially on the podcast. You were on in audio form, I guess, or whatever, one time. But you're now a live person on the podcast. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
It's great to have you here. So, yeah, like I said, we're going to be talking about the album war. This is a continuation of our series, our U240 series of going album by album and song by song, minute by minute of U2's life, as it were. But before we get to that, we have a couple of things to chat about briefly. As you may have seen on atut.com, we have an event coming up in September, late September, in Cleveland. And Tasula, you know some details that you can share with the folks?
Well, we're still ironing out the specifics, but you definitely want to plan to be there September 24th and 25th if you're going to come to Cleveland to celebrate with us. We're working out some pretty exciting stuff with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and Museum. So that's the location. We can confirm that. We've also posted on At U2 some hotels in the area that are offering good deals during that time frame. So if you want to book your travel, please go ahead and do that before the rooms book up. And we should be making an announcement on the ticket prices and everything else very, very soon, like this week. So stay tuned to the homepage for that.
Yeah. As we record this will go out, of course, and you might listen to this later. So it might actually be there by the time you're listening, depending on when you listen.
You very
to the
well
podcast.
Could. Yeah.
But yeah, definitely check out at u2.com. And like Tasula said, I booked my hotel already. So my hotel, not a whole hotel, just a room.
Okay, crazy. Whoa.
Just the floor. Yeah. Just need a floor. Just need some
privacy. And do you want to share what you might have a hand in doing there, Chris, while we're
I was trying to think, what am I doing? We might be doing a podcast, a live recording of the podcast. And
he's already forgotten his work duties. Yeah. So much.
Right.
So we're going to, again, just like Tasula said, lots of details still to be ironed out exactly how it'll all play out. We're hoping to definitely do a live one there, whether we can also figure out the live streaming angle on that too. We'll hopefully be able to do that. I'm sure someone can Facebook Live, Periscope, something, whatever, the recording as well. But yeah, I'm sure there'll be lots of live things going on. But you'll want to pay attention to the Twitter account of At U2, of course, ATU2 on Twitter, to be made aware of. So yeah, it's going to be exciting. Becky and Marilyn, are you guys going to be there as well?
Yes, absolutely. Just bought my air ticket yesterday, so I'm excited. I can't wait. It's always fun getting together with this group and with the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, you know, supporting this in such a big way. It will be even better.
Yeah, we've had two previous events there, so we know that they put on a wonderful presentation.
Yeah, it'll be just a lot of fun.
Yeah, looking forward to it. Marilyn, how about you?
Yes, I'm definitely going to be there. I live fairly close to Cleveland, and there's really no reason to go there other than for the Rock Hall. So,
no offense, Ohio.
No offense, Ohio.
Yeah. There's another reason. We went to the Christmas Story House last time we were there together.
Oh, that's right.
Thanks for losing us.
Two reasons.
There are some fun things to do in Cleveland. Let's not knock it.
I'm not going to be harsh on Cleveland because I do go there for concerts because they get some concerts that we don't get. So we definitely go there often enough. So I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah. Sorry to lose all of Ohio as a listener, but
it's that Ohio, Pennsylvania thing. I'm sure other states do the same.
Yeah.
Have the same rivalry.
Yeah, exactly. Who knows? Maybe by then we'll have some new album the way Bono's been talking, of course. Just a quick bit of tour or news update anyways, just in case you haven't read it on the site, and the podcast is where you get a bit of your U2 news anyways. Bono, Edge, and Adam Clayton were in Spain, and they attended a wedding and took photos of fans, etc. And they chatted with U2 in España and met the band there and asked about the songs they've experienced. Bono said, "It's not finished yet, but you will like it." So there's that. And in terms of lyrics, it's stronger than War. So perfect that we're talking about War this episode, and it has more clarity. So what do you guys think of Bono's proclamations about what it is? Oh, and it's, you might see a few things in September or October, though, which is probably alluding to some of the recent concert announcements and stuff that they're doing. But who knows? What do you think of Bono's announcements to Zula, or proclamations?
I take them with a grain of salt.
Yeah.
I mean, I do think they're making progress. I mean, we keep seeing pictures of them in the studio, and, you know, then they go to a wedding in Spain, and then they go back to the studio, and then they're, you know, then Larry's in Monaco. Oh, but then he's in the studio. So, you know, I mean, I hope and I want it to be true, but I know those guys well enough to know that we've got a little bit of a wait.
Yeah. You don't think we'll be unwrapping a new album at the U240 Cleveland event, eh?
I think that's a little ambitious, but maybe by Christmas. Oh. Maybe by the end of the year.
All right. I can wait till Christmas.
Yeah. They like to do stuff in November. That's you know, fourth quarter fun for them. They do stuff around Thanksgiving, around American Thanksgiving.
Right.
So, yeah.
We'll see if Bono touches Tim Cook's hand again to release an album, or what they...
You and that finger thing, huh?
Oh, Lord. No.
I know, that's the one there's many unifying things, I'm sure, but the Apple fans and the U2 fans both hope that never happens again.
That's probably true. Yeah.
But yeah, they're playing, as we've talked about, I think, in the previous episode, and just to make you aware, that they're playing the iHeartRadio Music Festival on September 23rd and performing at Dreamforce on October 5th. So two little, not full concerts for them per se, but events anyways that they're going to be playing at, and they're headlining. And so, yeah, we'll see if
we will have correspondence at both events. So
nice.
Stay tuned again. if news does break, we will have somebody on site to break it for you.
Yeah. And the iHeartRadio one is going to be live streamed, right? Is that what we're hearing?
That's what we're hearing. Yeah.
Yeah. So,
everybody gets to watch that, even if you don't have tickets.
So yeah, that'll be something to look forward to, possibly in Cleveland that we're doing. All right. Well, let's get into the roundtable discussion about War. And before we do, we have a couple of questions and comments from listeners that sent in comments through the hashtag AskAtU2 on Twitter. And we'll integrate some of the other ones that people sent in as appropriate about the album, about songs from the album. But at B Flozen Rab, sorry.
I always want a mashup of you pronouncing all these names.
There you go. Somebody go back and make an edit of that
at the end of the shows. Yeah.
When we retire the show, then that'll be what I spend my time doing. War is the first U2 album I listened to in full, along with October. Favorite song, Sunday Blaze Sunday, Seconds, New Year's Day, and 40. Great energy.
Half the album,
but yeah,
I know. I know.
Any U2 list ends up being like, oh no, I just need to include one more song. At JabW10 mentioned, speaking of War, thoughts on Bono's quote that the new album is stronger than War. Yes, consider the source, but still, smiley face. Which
was this? Was it Enemy or something? Like, what was the source? Do you remember?
Well, the
Bono. Oh, you are or the source being Bono.
Yeah.
Oh, I thought you meant like the. Or I thought he meant the magazine. Okay.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
No, but that's fair. Consider the source Bono. Yeah.
Bono right. Sounding, or Edge is sounding more metal than he ever has, and you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Oh, he's on fire again. Yeah. Isn't he always? No offense, Bono. I mean,
yeah.
We love you.
If you're listening, I'm sure.
I like that Bono is even thinking, if this really came out of his mouth, which I assume it did, I like that he's thinking about War, about the strength of this album in reference to something today. That's cool.
Yeah, it's a very interesting comparison to go back to that, like not just, you know, the last album or the two, you know, the current generation of albums or whatever, but like to go way back to War as a reference point. It's pretty cool. So obviously it's in their brain, or in his brain anyways. And by way of leading us into the discussion, at underscore big wave underscore, War was my in to U2. And he mentioned the quote, and the battle's yet begun to claim the victory Jesus won is a lyric I'm still reeling at 33 years on. So definitely some, obviously some spiritual components to the album as well, as with much of U2. So if this is your first episode of the U2 podcast, you're listening to, we're doing a bit of a series. We're going from Boy to Songs of Innocence. or Songs of Experience if it comes out. And
by the time we finish.
Yeah. We started with episode number 34. So if you go back to goodstuff.fm/ATU2/34 with Boy. And then now we're at War. So anybody have comments on, I guess, where U2 was at during the recording of War and what sort of this headspace they might have been in?
I have Matt's book here, Matt McGee's.
I'm not familiar with him.
U2, A Diary. I know you're new to this site, so. And it says that August 8th, 1982 was the Edge's 21st birthday, and U2 began work on their album, War, at Windmill Lane Studios in Dublin. Though they had considered other producers, Steve Lillywhite joins them to produce his third straight U2 album. So they go in and they're with someone they're comfortable with. And they just decide they want to sound like The Clash. And
that was Bono.
Yeah. It's Bono screaming at The Edge, don't do that. Don't be like The Edge. Be like Mick Jones, trying to get Edge to be a little more aggressive. And I think it worked because the whole album seems fairly aggressive compared to the first two albums.
Yeah, that's what, definitely you can hear. I think anyways, just like a marked change in style and production value and just overall competency of the band as a unit on this album that you didn't hear in the same way, like drastically anyways, from previous albums. And so it's definitely for me the first one of my favorite early U2 albums for sure. So Tasula, how about you? I know you've mentioned that you enjoy the album occasionally.
Well, yeah. I mean, what do you want me to add? I don't know that I have much to add in this regard.
Right. So the album itself, though, the album cover art and things like that, Cecilia, you had, I guess, some comment on, you had interviewed the
that boys. I can speak to, yeah.
Right.
So back in 2006, I interviewed Peter Rowan, who is, fans may know Googie, who is Bono's best friend. He's Googie's younger brother, and he is the kid that appears on the cover of Boy and War and the best of 80 to 90, I guess it is. And he was 8 years old at the time of this photo shoot and was horsing around. And I think he was on a skateboard, if I remember correctly, and fell and tripped and cut his lip. And they were going to like clean him up. And the photographer's like, no, you know, let's just leave him as is for this photo shoot. And there was actually a big story about how he got paid, because everybody wondered if he got all these royalties for this iconic film, you know, or this iconic album cover. And no, he was paid in Mars bars, and that's exactly how he wanted to be paid when he was 8 years old. And they had him up against a blank wall. And if folks who have the Stealing Hearts at a Traveling Show book that Steve Avril and Sean McGrath put out a few years ago, they can see the contact sheets for this. But he was up against like a plain background with a helmet on, like he is in the best of. And that wasn't working for what they wanted to convey. They wanted to convey not just, you know, the horrors of war, but what war does to people and children specifically, of course. And so they actually found some corrugated metal or cardboard or something that they put behind his head, which is the texture that you see behind him. And then his lip being freshly cut by an actual accident made it look all the more, you know, rugged for the cover. And, you know, he remembers from that day, he said he remembers two things: that the soup that they fed him was terrible. somebody's wife made soup and gave them soup and he hated it. And that Bono almost killed them driving them somewhere afterward, which is, you know, a common story we hear from so many people that ride with
Bono. What a surprise.
He's a terrible driver.
Right.
but I think that it's cute that he was eight, you know, and this was his memory. And now, of course, he has gone on to become a famous photographer in his own right, which is pretty cool. And he does, from time to time, shoot U2 shows.
Yeah, he's got a great site, peterrowan.com. Link will be in the show notes where you can see his work. And then you can also follow him on Twitter. He's not like I guess probably some people in the U2 world think of him as being fairly famous or infamous, but he's not, you know, he's just a normal guy.
Yeah.
On the cover of a hugely selling album.
Yeah, and the funny thing was when I interviewed him, I found out that he didn't even own those albums. So as a thank you for being interviewed, I sent him War with a box of Mars bars. Nice. and he loved it. We still talk. He's still a friend. We still talk. But yeah.
That's cool.
I thought that was crazy though, that if you're the kid on this cover, how could you not? And he's like, oh, I have some of their other albums that I listen to all the time. I just don't happen to have War or Boy. And I'm like, why wouldn't you have War and Boy? But anyway, yeah, now he has one of them. So
that's hilarious. Yeah, it's about, and when the album came out, it was, I hadn't realized this, that it was like as a biggest success, I guess, in UK, where it knocked, I'm just reading from Wikipedia here, but like they knocked Thriller off the top charts at the time, mm-hmm. which, to become a number one album, the band's first number one album in the UK. So, it's just interesting the time frame that puts it in, obviously, for any, you know, if you're a pop fan and think of Michael Jackson and stuff back in the 80s, and this album comes out and that's kind of like what people are listening to and the sort of zeitgeist, I guess, or whatever at the time. And still ranks fairly highly. In 2012, the album was number 223 on Rolling Stone magazine's list of 500 greatest albums of all time. So whatever those lists are worth, it's at least on them anyways, as an album that is very well received in hindsight. So, but yeah, it's a very, very iconic album, very, like I said, aggressive. And Marilyn said, you know, it's just kind of a transition period of being a little more aggressive and less laid back edge. So, what was it like, I guess, for folks, I don't know who would want to chat to, I guess, about the idea of like listening when you heard it for the first time, and maybe, Becky, I don't know if you have comments here, but like what it was like when you first heard the album come out or first heard it yourself.
Yeah. I think for me, when certainly I was familiar with U2 prior to this and I liked them, but I was in high school and headed to college, but when this album came out, it just grabbed me. It was like they were starting to mature, their sound was getting more solid, they were adding more songs to their repertoire, which I think was probably great for people going to the live shows at the time. You know, they were refining their act and they started moving into some arenas at that point, I believe, in a few places. And coming out of the October album, you know, in that era, it was just a little bit different sound. And I think I was a big fan of, you know, punk and then sort of new wave at the time, because it's what was playing in all the clubs and would go dancing. And the U2 song, Sunday Bloody Sunday, you know, and New Year's Day were everywhere. And I think I just heard so much of it there, but it was really the music and the beat and the vibe that got my attention. And it was fun. Even though if you listen to the lyrics, it was much deeper. But on one level, it was just, I thought it was fun to hear it in the clubs and dance to it and all of that. I thought about the lyrics separately and where they were going with the album much later, actually.
Right, which brings up, I don't want to jump ahead too far into the song discussion, but fellow at U2 site writer and podcast co-host Sherry had mentioned would love to hear thoughts on the Two Hearts Beat as One music video and dance remixes. Why the need for dance remixes anyway, is what she had sent in through the hashtag Ask at U2. And so is that stuff, like, is that sort of what you would have been hearing or dancing to, or was it more actually just like the rock?
More of the things that were in the top 40 or 50 or wherever they landed in the US. I don't remember. They started, did this album hit around 91 and then moved up pretty high, I think, pretty quickly.
Once it got MTV airplay, it did.
Yes.
Yeah, it was number 12 in the US, I think.
Yeah,
the video in the snow. Right.
Oh,
Lord. It would have been something like that. Although Two Hearts to me, I love that song because, you know, he wrote that on their honeymoon. And that's such a nice song. Very sweet.
It was the last video I watched before we started taping.
Oh, there you go.
Oh.
How about you, Marilyn? Do you remember hearing it for the first time and sort of what your response was to it?
Yeah. At the time, I was pretty much an REM fan. They were my favorite band at that time. And this was very, very, very different than the REM stuff that was out. This is an interesting time in music history, I guess, or what's on the charts. You have the end of the 70s and sort of that big rock sound like The Who, who were still touring at this time, and The Clash, who were sort of taking that big rock sound and putting that punk spin on it. And then you had all the punk stuff that was out. And then you had all the new kind of new wave music that was coming out. And this was kind of fit into all of that. You know, you had these driving songs, you had dance songs. So you have all these different, this amalgam of different types of music, and you can sort of hear it in War. I love this album. I still love this album. It still makes me feel like I'm 18. You know, like I still get angry when I listen to it. I want to scream really loud and jump around the kitchen while I'm doing dishes. You know,
nice.
My kids love that part too when I'm, you know. So, you know, and I had a big mullet like Bono did, and, you know, that was the deal.
I want to see a picture of that.
Yeah, I'll make sure you tweet out the pictures or whatever later.
Oh, there will be no tweeting of the pictures.
Hey, I tweeted out my mermaid picture last time. So.
Well, you have no shame.
That's right. That's true.
That picture.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, so, and it's funny, for me coming back, I'm Actung Baby U2 fan and working my way backwards. It was kind of like, you know, I remember sitting around with friends and playing pool or whatever, and we'd be listening to Actung, and then someone would throw this on. It was like the classic U2, you know, like old school U2. And there's debate about whether we really like the old U2 or not, you know, and how that all goes. And so it's just kind of funny the different spaces that we're in hearing this album for the first time. And for me, it definitely felt and sounded very raw and, you know, unproduced compared to Actung, especially obviously at the time. And but yeah, definitely, you know, it's hard to like you separate the live experience of U2, which I would have heard at least at that time, and going back to an album version of a song, kind of like, you know, once you hear stuff live anyways, for me with U2, it kind of comes alive in a different way. And so but yeah, still listening through back to the song through the album in preparation for this podcast, and just kind of amazed at just the depth and the quality of the recording and this musicianship that the whole band, especially Adam Clayton, kind of, I poke fun at him for his solo on October last episode, I think it was, but definitely he came into his own on this album. But we'll chat about that in a moment when we go song by song. But just in terms of where the name came from, and it's fairly obvious, and Bono had said the album was called War because war seemed to be the motif for 1982. Everywhere you looked, from the Falklands, the Middle East, and South Africa, there was war. By calling the album War, we're giving people a slap in the face and at the same time getting away from the cozy image a lot of people have of U2. So,
yeah, and one more thing on the album cover that I forgot. They actually chose the font and the color of the font and the placement of how War is written down the side to mimic classic 80s magazines of the time, like Life and Time, that were always reporting on war.
Interesting. So,
yeah.
It's interesting in light of U2 being a little more, it's fairly direct and like in your face. There isn't very subtle as to what they're talking about, right? They're not trying to hide it in any sort of, artistic, whatever intention there. It's just in your face. So anyways, let's get to the songs that we want to discuss about this album. So not that we need any introduction, really, I don't think, for queuing the songs, but I'll, for the live listeners, you'll hear a bit of the song before we get into it, just to help refresh everybody's brain, and then it'll be in the podcast version as well, a little sample. But first up on the album is Sunday Bloody Sunday. Marilyn, I don't know if you want to lead this one off. It's a fairly popular song with you two. Oh, most people should be familiar with it.
Yes. So, okay. So you have these first two albums of U2, and this is their third album. And this song, I think, more than any other U2 song, pretty much is sets the blueprint for what the rest of their career is going to be like. This is an excellent first song. This is an in-your-face song. They come right out, drums and bass, and then Bono just rips right into it, and he's incredulous about what's going on in the world. And what I love about this song is that he is not taking sides, which is in Ireland at the time, with all the fighting that they had, it was easy to choose one side or the other. And I guess that was the protocol. You chose one side or the other. And in this song, he doesn't choose sides. He's on the side of humanity. He wants everybody to stop the ridiculous fighting. And it's, I know a lot of people who say that this is their best song ever. And they, my friend Nicole, who's an excellent U2 fan, she will argue hours with you about how this is their best song, and everything that comes after it is just, you know, B-sides.
So, even your dog is intrigued.
That is not my dog.
Oh, that, someone else was hard to tell where in the world the barking is coming from. But the
yeah, but I really love this song for that reason. They just, you really get a sense that this is a band that's going to be in your face, and they're going to call you out. And they feel, I think at this point, they feel a little more comfortable with their musicianship. They're being a little bolder in their choices. The drums are louder, the bass is louder, everything's louder. And again, you know, they just, Bono is talking about social issues. He doesn't give you any kind of answer to these problems, but he's bringing them to your attention, and he really wants you to think about what's going on. So I know, Tasula, this is also one of your favorite songs.
Oh, yes. I love it so much.
I know you do.
What in the chat room, Fabiano Mad had mentioned Sunday Bloody Sunday was the first music that was a success in Brazil. And until today, when you say talk about U2, even for a non U2 fan, everybody knows and likes Sunday Bloody Sunday, which is just a testament, I think, to the song, the band, obviously, but the song especially, of that staying power. Because it has a production style that is slightly 80s-ish, but not really. Like, it's just a rock song in that sense, I guess. But it's definitely been able to morph into different places it needs to fit in terms of their tours and different themes they're trying to talk about and things on the live tour, live stage and stuff. And only a great song, I think, can do that. It can't just be any song that will do that. So, Cecilia was making fun of me for this one. At Furrow mentioned in the from hashtag Ask at U2, I feel like Sunday Bloody Sunday lost its strength and passion on the last tour and needs a break. Would love to see Seconds replace it. Your thoughts? And so, by way of let's jump into Seconds, but I'll just play a little sample of it before we go.
Say goodbye, say goodbye, oh.
Sula, how about you? I'm going to lead off the discussion on this one.
Ooh, sure. So I don't know that I would want it to answer the question you just mentioned. Right. I don't want anything to replace Sunday Bloody Sunday. That's a sacrilege, and shame on you for even suggesting it. But but however, I would love to hear seconds. In addition to, as a bonus of, I think that this was such a great song to take from Sunday Bloody Sunday. I mean, the order of the songs specifically, because it's a drum song. Again, of course, Sunday Bloody Sunday starts with these iconic drums. And now Seconds is also starting with drums. And it's very military. And of course, you hear that sample in there, that I want to live a life of danger, whatever. For those who don't know, that sample was put in because Bono and Edge were sitting there watching a documentary called Soldier Girls in 1981. And I just think it's so hilarious that these badass little rock stars were sitting there watching a documentary about females in the army. You know, like, is that really what guys that age did at that time? You know, not your average guy, but these guys, yeah, it's not that odd that they'd be sitting there watching a scholarly documentary on women in the service. So anyway, I watched Soldier Girls this weekend for the first time. It's free on Amazon Prime, Americans, and maybe Canadians. I don't know.
There's a version on YouTube that may or may not be, you know, legal.
Oh, the complete or the complete. Yeah, maybe. Yeah. I don't know. It's not very long, though. And it's a Nick Broomfield. Those of you who like documentaries, it's a decent movie anyway. But I love the fact that they just happened to be watching this while they were working on this album that is so focused on war, and, you know, that made it into the set. And I also was very curious about why Edge was chosen to sing. This is the first song on any U2 album that is not sung by Bono, right? Mm-hmm. And I asked Steve Lillywhite when I interviewed him 3 years ago what the decision was behind that. He didn't even remember. He was like, I don't know. I'm looking at my interview right now. Oh my God, I don't know. Wow, that's the first time I've been asked that. And I'm trying to remember. That's weird. Is it the second song on the album? And then I say, it is. And he says, it's the second song on the album. And then you've got a different singer. Very strange. You know, I haven't listened to the album for many years because I never do. And there are some strange things that are unique to War that are not like any other U2 album. Things like trumpet solos. So if he doesn't remember, and he was obviously one of the decision makers in the room at the time, I don't know if we'll ever get the story, but I do think it's super cool that they let or, you know, I don't know if let's the right word,
or
but
made, yeah, forced.
Nominated, asked, chose Edge to sing because he does have a great voice and you can hear his youth in it. I don't know how to say it better than that. You can hear his youth in it. I think it would sound different today if he sang it today.
Yeah, I think that's what I know. There's a line in the Bill Flanagan book about, you know, people were shocked to see Edge step up to the mic to sing the song when it was played live or whatever. Not because they do sound close enough that, you know, the average listener could be like, just sounds like Bono with a slightly different intonation or whatever. But yeah, it's there. I get what you're saying as far as the youthfulness in his voice and stuff. And I think it has a little less of that edge for
no pun intended.
Yeah. Right. That Bono seems to bring to most every other song on the album, which that's hilarious to me though, that Steve Lillywhite wouldn't even remember that Edge. It seems like in U2 fandom or whatever, it's a fairly remarkable event that, you know, Bono isn't lead singer. Yeah.
And you'd think that would have been like a big deal in the room at least, but maybe it wasn't.
Like, there's got to be a version they recorded with Bono.
I would think, right?
Yeah.
So just to jump in, I was reading, I think it was in the YouTube by YouTube book, might have been where they were talking about this, and Edge was doing some of the recording on it, so that's why he was singing, and then he had assumed Bono would take over the lyrics and he would do the vocals on that. But then Bono said, no, I want you to do it. Mm. And that was the decision. And Edge was like, are you sure or whatever?
He was nominated.
So he was nominated. Yes. I think they happened into it is how I interpreted that. But then they said, oh, this is a good idea. And that's how it came out.
Yeah, it's kind of like maybe he was doing the demo of it or whatever and writing it. And then they said, your version sounds good enough. Or
because he's always the one that goes into the studio or at his house or wherever he happens to be. And he's constantly, you know, working and coming up with things. And this was one of those examples.
Yeah, and at KWalsh12 mentioned a comment saying, anyone else think Seconds is an underrated song? I'd say yes.
Yeah, absolutely.
And also, is this the album with the least echo? Edge trying to get away from delay, which I know, Marilyn, you'd mentioned earlier too, just you know, in terms of trying to be more Clash and less Edge. And definitely that's a common theme as well throughout. It's still there, but definitely not in the same kind of way that was before and will be, I guess. Spoiler alerts, he brings back the echo in future albums.
Can I just say that I'm embarrassed that I didn't realize that this was the Edge singing
for
a long time. It took me a long time to realize.
Oh, I thought you were saying like tonight. And I was like, we are taking your badge away.
No.
We're taking your badge away.
I was at least 40 when I figured it out. So.
No.
But yeah, at the beginning I didn't, because their voices are so similar at that age. You're right. They do sound really, really young on this album.
Yeah.
I think honestly, it's one of my favorite songs, the Adam's bass line on it. And, which is a good reoccurring theme, but, as far as big hits, Sunday Bloody Sunday, et cetera, are great, but, it's one of my favorite songs that I go to on this album. So anyways, let's move on to another little ditty they had. The intro is too long to get to any lyrics before we get hit by a copyright lawyer. But Marilyn, do you want to take off the discussion on New Year's Day in case somebody wasn't aware what song that was?
In case you didn't know, that was New Year's Day by U2. Another song that follows this theme of the impending apocalypse. the lyrics are, you know, Bono's, he's, just incensed about what's happening in the world. And he feels like he has to be with this person in this horrible, horrible world, it's the end of the world and nothing changes on New Year's Day because, that's really true. Nothing ever changes on New Year's Day. Everybody's resolutions are gone on January 2nd. And I have to agree with him on that. But this is a huge, huge song for them back then. This song was everywhere. MTV, college radio, everywhere.
VH1.
Friday Night Videos. I don't think VH1 was around yet at that point.
That's true, yeah.
I'm going to look that up.
In 1983?
Yeah, so New Year's Day was the album's...
Looking it up.
And internationally, it was the album's lead single, right? So this is...
Yeah, we didn't get Sunday Bloody Sunday in America the way that the rest of the world did.
Yeah. Matt's book says Two Hearts Beat as One...
Yeah, we had
to release in Ireland, UK, France, Australia, Japan, and the US.
And you are right about VH1. It wasn't until New Year's Day, 1985.
Oh, that's why you were thinking of it.
That's
took
it
a little while.
Oh, you young.
There was
young
a connection.
People.
Yeah.
Kids.
I was 10. I was 10 when it was launched. How cool is that?
Oh, Lord. Don't go there.
At Kevin STU mentioned it's his favorite track on War and still consider it as a whole flawless. And at BZ05 asked, will you guys touch on the alternate lyrics for New Year's Day in one of the remixes? And I don't know which, does anybody know about the remix? I know they are out there. I don't know them intimately enough to.
I have them. I just don't listen to them. Like, why would I, you know? I mean, no offense, but why mess with something that's perfect to begin with, you know?
Right.
I'm not a remix girl in very many circumstances, let's just say.
All right. Well, good to know.
I mean, ladies, are you? The only person on the show. So
there are some remixes that I really like, but I have to say on this one, I think this song is perfect the way it is. To me, these lyrics just hit me in the gut. And it's so good. I love, love, love this song. And it's the color, you know, under a blood red sky, you know, a crowd is gathered in black and white. And then he talks about gold later, and I know it's golden age, and gold is the reason for the wars we wage. But the imagery that he's so brilliant at putting together, I just love this song.
Are we going to talk about the video?
Really like see it.
The horses and all the randomness of the horse riding?
Well, now the video is a difference.
Larry's peacoat? I mean, come on.
Is this the video where
they're freezing in the snow?
Yes. Wasn't Edge complaining that Duran Duran got to go to the, you know,
yeah, they were
the Caribbean to shoot their video, yes. and these guys were up in some tundra somewhere on horses,
and they're like helicoptered like in,
Sweden.
Right?
I think they were in Sweden, but yeah,
freezing.
Yeah. Or yeah, and I didn't know until very recently when I was reading about this. I was just looking it up again. Apparently, it was so cold they had four women stand in for them on the horses.
They did. That's true.
Because they didn't have insurance, they couldn't get hurt. And I think after the fact, you know, their fingers were so, they were just really cold. And of course, they're all freezing, but I didn't know about those women.
Hilarious.
Pretty entertaining. Yeah, that's a random video. It's not my favorite.
Yeah, you two's had a hit and miss history with music videos for sure. But I think live, anyways, this song is always one of those ones that I feel like I'm tired of hearing, sorry if that offends anybody, but I feel like I'm tired of hearing it, but then I inevitably find myself not skipping it or whatever on a video. And not that I really, you know, I'm in that much of a rush to get through a concert video or whatever, but, and I'm always impressed, especially by Edge's, just again, musicianship on it, where he's got the guitar and he's playing piano chords and back and forth between the two and jumping from the piano to a guitar solo. And I know at this point he's played it so many times over the years, but still it's a technical feat, I guess, of being able to do that and doing it well and consistently. And I know when I was watching the Songs of Innocence tour video, I tweeted about how precisely he plays even the piano chords on this song when he's playing it live, and you can just see the like focus in his demeanor and stuff when he's playing it. But yeah, still love it, and it gets the crowd jumps obviously and is going insane when they play the song. So
I kind of felt the same way you'd. I mean, I'll agree with you that I was getting over it, so to speak, live. But then I heard it that week of my birthday in Dublin, and it totally came back for me. Like the crowd lost it. You know, yeah. It was like it was the crowd pleaser for that crowd, and these are old hardcore Irish fans. You know, and it was great to hear. So
yeah. And I think the structure of the song is such that they can change the lyrics over and over again to fit whatever situation is happening in the world right now as they're touring. So it just brings more people to the song, I think. Even though I know you don't like the remixes to Sula, I think that.
I was going to say, I don't think they changed any of the words in Ireland, but I hear what you're saying, I guess. Yeah.
All right, moving on. We got to keep moving. Otherwise, this will be another 3-hour podcast that we end up with. But moving on to track number 4 is Like a Song. Right, another one that starts with a heavy bass or heavy drum intro, and I think, in as much as Adam came into his own on this. Definitely Larry has his own moments too, where he's, you know, obviously like Marilyn mentioned at the beginning, getting aggressive and having a lot of fun, I hope. You never know with Larry. Having fun playing the drums on this this album and in the studio and stuff. And so, I don't know, Tasula, do you have any comments on Like a Song?
I do. I always thought it was kind of a filler song, not a bad song, but it's definitely not a standout for all of the great songs that are on this album. But I do like it, and I always have liked it. And I thought the lyrics were especially sophisticated for this age for the band members. Mm-hmm. And I remember when I went, again, I'm going to reference this. I think I referenced it on the last show, so forgive me, but I went to the Conan O'Brien show back when U2 was going to be on there on his show, his old show before he had the Tonight Show, and stood in line all night with my sister and, you know, whatever. Conan came to the line the next morning to greet all of us fans and do a little bit for the taped part of the broadcast later in the show. And he did U2 trivia while we were standing there. And he chose this guy next to me who maybe had never even heard of U2 to participate. And I was about to burst. And the lyric was from this song. And he just said the lyric. And I was like, oh, it's like a song. You know, I couldn't say it. But I knew it was like a song. It was from my favorite album. And my sister's like physically holding me back. Like she's got a hold of me. You can see it in the tape. Like we're on the show.
Oh, nice.
And you can see it. I have the VHS of me like just trying so hard. And the guy like looks at me and like sneers at me and goes, you know it, don't you? Or whatever. And I was like, yeah, it's like a song. So I totally like stole the guy's trivia moment. But anyway, yeah. So my point is, if that had been New Year's Day or Sunday Bloody Sunday, even as a casual fan, he probably would have known it. But it was like a song and no one knew it. No one around us knew it. And me and my sister were probably the only people in that little group that knew it. You know, except for the really bad diehards that were 10 people in front of us that had been there for 2 days. But anyway, yeah. So I think it gets not enough attention because of the placement on the album and because the other songs are just so good. But on a mediocre album, this would have been a standout.
Mm-hmm. I can honestly say I don't know if I knew that this was actually what the lyrics were. And I don't know if this is the one that Conan was referencing, but second stanza is, and in leather, lace, and chains, we stake our claim, revolution.
No, it was the wear a badge line.
Right, okay.
Yeah.
Anyway,
you wouldn't have used that. It was a family show. No.
Yeah, anyway, I don't think I ever actually connected that was what the lyric was in that second line of the song or second stanza. But and just going a bit of follow-up or whatever from earlier in the show, a YouTube fan in the chat room didn't realize it was the Edge singing seconds either, and we just actually spoiled it for them on the show. So if you were out there listening and also
there's
didn't
no
realize
Santa.
Yeah
there's
no Santa Claus.
Suma.
You're not alone in not knowing that was Edge. And like I said, it took I wasn't until I read Flanagan's book that I even realized it wasn't Bono. So yeah, that's how close they are sounding anyways back then. So moving on, let's go to Drowning Man. But fell into just listening to the music there and forgot about the podcast.
I hear you.
Hi. Marilyn, do you want to take the lead on this one?
Oh, I love this song. There's a lot of reasons why I love this song. I love how Bono can't really sing this song. He sounds like he's struggling a little bit to croon. He's not really a crooner at this point in their career. He's more of a screamer and a yeller. And, you know, he sings from his lower abdomen. But in this one, I think he's really trying hard to sing this as a love song. And I don't think he's too successful in that, only because he's just so young. And he hasn't really been able to harness his voice the way he does now. I would love to hear the song now with his new Bono voice and not the young, you know, the young Bono voice. Cause I think it would be gorgeous. This is a great love song. And I used to sing this song to my kids when they were little and they were crying and they couldn't be consoled. And, so I have a lot of very, nice memories of singing the song, with my kids. And as is so often with Bono's, lyrics, it's really about him. I think he wants his love, the love of his life, to take his hand. He's the drowning man. That's my theory. I don't know if that's true or not, but, just a great, quiet, not so quiet love song.
Yeah, you two War 40 mentioned Drowning Man was the band's first true ballad, and it still stands up today. We were teased by them when they rehearsed it live, which I have in the little site tours.atu2.com mentions that it was a snippeted in 2009 and 2005. Did they rehearse it somewhere more recently than that? Anybody know? I'm guessing not.
Did they do it last year?
I feel like, I don't think they did it last year, but I think late in 360.
Yeah.
We were still hoping for it late in 360 and it didn't happen.
Because there was a snippet of it in the Netherlands, apparently. But before that, it's 83 is when it was last played. Snippets of it, sorry, even then. So, it looks like if this is... Well, all of these actually are referenced as snippets. So I don't know if it was, has it ever actually been played in its full entirety.
I will. I
not according to Drowning Man on the tours database, but.
It's not?
No.
It hasn't?
No. So, which is interesting. I mean, maybe musically wise, it is a weird, more interesting one as far as edge guitar, and it's more acoustic, which is not typically, they don't have a lot of acoustic songs and definitely wouldn't have back then. So maybe just, musically, it was more difficult to play and didn't want to try and incorporate it into a set. But
I think it's the singing. I think it's too hard to sing.
Yeah.
I really do.
At YouTube,
right. I don't think it's the instruments. I think it's Bono's mouth, voice.
His lower abdomen.
His lower abdomen.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. That's what UTGW asked. Why do you think it is that Drowning Man has never been managed to find its way into any live show sets? So there you go. Blame his abdomen or his mouth. One of the two.
I think he would struggle with it. Unless he did something with it like they did with Every Breaking Wave, you know, last year. I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know how they would arrange it and do it.
Oh, chat room update here from Fabiano. They rehearsed Drowning Man on the 360 tour but didn't play it in Barcelona 2009. So somebody's got a YouTube link.
It was the opener. Barcelona was the opener. So,
Yeah.
There you go.
So really set the bar.
Thanks.
Whoa.
You got a little blast. I'll put a link to the show notes to the YouTube video that apparently has, I won't play it right now, Drowning Man rehearsal, which you can find at goodstuff.fm/ATU2/37 is where we're at. So moving on to The Refugee.
She's starting to have her reactions again.
I am.
Time it was to Larry, I think.
Yeah, okay, so what are the gigs about?
This time. I don't know. This is one of those songs on the album, too, that just, it's the music. It just grabs you. And, you know, it's simple, but this song, clearly, you look at it today, it's still relevant. I think most of the album is still relevant today and through time, which is something just amazes me about their music. But this album is timeless. And I think this, it's really the music, it's the beat, it's very simple, but it's it I don't know. I just like it.
I'm wondering if this is, we need to have a alternate, like the Tours database, but music instruments database. Is this the only use of cowbell in a U2 song? That's what I hear it as. Anyway.
It very well could be.
Which
trivia question.
Yeah. Don't tell Matt. We'll use that for his, get him to guessing the song trivia, the live recording. But yeah, to me, it's funny you mentioned that, because to me, this one is sounds the most 80s-ish kind of sound. And maybe it's just like the weird echo reverb on Bono's voice. And I tied the guitar effect, though, in Edge's kind of little solo, lazy Edge solo, to the Holy Joe sound and pop, like era kind of thing. There's kind of a weird connection there. But yeah, looking at the lyrics, it's definitely like heavy lyrics and stuff that are going on, obviously. And like you said, timeless, but musically for me anyways, it's hard to like get past some of the kind of head bopping 80s kind of sound to it. But yeah.
I probably wish they made a video for it. I wish they made a video. Because it would have been so fun. It would have been so perfect for the time. Like Chris said, it's very, very 1983.
Yes.
It would fit right in with Adam Ant, you know? It's like,
probably why I like it.
No, I like it too. And I will never hear Larry play those drums, and that's what I wish we would.
The drums are awesome. Yeah. It's
Do we all need a moment here for Larry's drums?
We might. We need a moment.
Need a pause.
We're verklempt.
And it's kind of like it's the beginning phases of the Bono howl too. The E-oh, you know, he's just starting to feel his groove there.
Yeah.
So yeah.
And that was a very 80s thing, that E-oh.
Absolutely
thing.
It was. Yeah. And he, you know, progressed it and evolved it to the howl that we've come to know and love. But
right.
The With or Without You and Electrical Storm, et cetera. But yeah.
He had to experiment somewhere, so he did it on The Refugee. All right, let's keep moving. Two Hearts Beat as One is next. All right, Marilyn, you want to lead this one off?
Oh, it's sad of mine. I can't help it.
Mm-hmm.
It's one of those wailing songs. Like, you just can't help it. Sing along.
Yeah.
So I like the remixes of this song. I have a memory of being underage and being at a frat party at a local university. I will not mention. and this song came on, and I was the only one out there, and I just stayed out there for the whole 12 minutes bouncing around to one of the remixes. I couldn't tell you which one. And I still love to dance around my kitchen to this song. And I think this is a good try at a pop song for you two. It's definitely a pop song. And I hear a lot of this song in a lot of songs from pop. And actually, I hear a lot of war in, there's a little bit of war in every U2 album, I think. So, but this, I hear a lot of this song in pop, which is my favorite U2 album.
You guys are killing me. You guys are absolutely killing me.
Please.
I was so annoyed that somebody related this to pop on my Twitter feed today. I was so annoyed. Now you're doing it.
Oh, you hate pop, don't you? I like it. I
hate pop, yeah. But, yeah.
Anyway. I wonder if we'll be at pop just in time for the live recording, Sula. That would be fun.
And the other thing I like about this song is... there's a little bit of Bono rapping on it. You know,
there's
that Beatles
a little
black
bit of rap. That's true.
Yeah, there's a little bit of rap on it. And it's, so I think that's pretty funny.
Here's a good
trivia rap
question.
Wasn't a thing back then.
Does anyone know who the acrobat was in the video for this?
No.
I don't either. I'm honestly asking. I really
no.
No.
I can tell you who the violin player was on Sunday Bloody Sunday. I can tell you who the guy on the cover of the albums. I don't know who the acrobat was. And I, of course, was scrambling to figure it out before we started, and I couldn't find it anywhere. So I don't know if we know.
Something to ask Steve Lillywhite next time you.
No, he won't remember. Right. He doesn't remember why Edge sang your second. How's he
well, it's true.
Yeah.
He's moved on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's interesting that they definitely looking through the lyrics on that one. It's definitely like you'd said, it like just pop kind of stuff with. Definitely on the lighter side of the album anyways. So, yeah, let's move on to Red Lights. Tasula, did you want to lead off this one or should I play it?
I'm happy to lead it off if you want. The part that goes, da-da-da, 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 da-da-da.
Pretty good.
Thank you.
Fair enough.
This one's fun.
Who's dancing?
Isn't that
me?
A great song?
Sorry, I am.
That's such a great song. So the funny story behind this one and why I was begging to sing that for you all. When I interviewed Steve, I asked about the women on the song, because that's not something you hear, with the exception of Songs of Innocence now with the Troubles. They don't really have backup singers for you two, but they did here, and they were clearly female. So I said, what was the deal with that? And it was Kid Creole and the Coconuts that happened to be, and there's conflicting stories, like Steve's story doesn't necessarily mesh with Paul McGuinness's story, which doesn't necessarily mess with Adam's story, so who knows? But somehow this band was in town and invited down to the studio, to Windmill Lane, where they were working on this. And they came in to listen to some things, and then the idea was tossed out, you know, that they would jump in and lend their voices. And they started doing it, and the timid little members of U2 were standing there, and one of the ladies says, well, you know, I sing better without my clothes on, and starts to take her top off. And U2 kind of freaked out, because they're little, innocent, sweet boys at the time. And she, of course, did not strip completely naked and sing the song. But it gave them a good laugh and loosened up the atmosphere, apparently. But yeah, they did have these ladies on the song. I think it's fantastic. I think that it would make a wonderful live performance, considering the screens and the lights that they use these days. I think they could do a beautiful cityscape, you know, doing the old red light district homage. I mean, I've got it in my head. I can't communicate it very well right now in the middle of a podcast. But anyway, Willie Williams, get on that. Like, this would be a great song live. And I would be happy to sing backup for them for free. You
for
know,
free. Yeah.
I'll do it for free. I'll do it for free.
Mars yeah. Bar, maybe?
I'll do it for free as well.
I'll do it for free. Yeah. We can rotate, you know.
Well, there were three of them, so.
Yeah. That's true, right? They would
do
voices, yeah. Very anyone cool. else like the song, or am I,
yeah.
am I on an island? No.
This is a fun song. I think it's just got a nice beat to it. And I do love the fact that they had, you know, women on this album. And you're right. We haven't heard that since until last year.
The yeah. other thing I like about this song is the horns.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. There's a
yeah.
trumpet.
Yeah.
yeah.
There's like, not a lot of horns on U2 albums.
Mm-hmm.
Or rock albums of that era, period.
No, exactly.
Right? So yeah, they were really taking a lot of risks that you wouldn't think a band that had a solid first album and a not so great or well-received sophomore album would take, I guess.
Yeah. And a bit of like the, you know, bands, especially that era these days, it tends to be a little less worry about that kind of stuff maybe, but you know, including other musicians and stuff was a bit of like a thing where you're like setting precedent for what kind of band you are. And do you allow trumpets, and do you allow other people, backup singers, as a thing, you know, and then are you going to bring them on tour or whatever, and how are you going to play the song live and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it's just interesting. And the experimentation, I guess, that kind of left U2 in terms of other artists. They did it, you know, obviously in the future on other bands with other compilations and all that kind of stuff. But on an actual U2 album, it's they haven't done as much of it. So it's interesting lyrically wise too with that one, how Bono is often thought of as having and is a really good lyricist. But often when you you're listening to the song, you don't really think too much about the lyrics, but it's basically like 80% of him saying, "I give you my love," which not to say that you can't have a song like that, but it's just kind of funny when you actually come just look at it on a screen or on a page or whatever of what he's actually saying each song or for the song or whatever. It's just kind of funny how that can make up.
Well,
up one song.
And in that era, Bono was learning how to be a better lyricist and a better writer. He wasn't very comfortable with it yet. And his wife had to basically push him out of bed every day and say, "Look, you know," he'd say, "I don't want to get out of bed." And she'd say, "You mean you don't want to write?" So she helped him, I think, with the discipline, or maybe pushed him. And this album was, I think he made a lot of strides.
Yeah, no, definitely. Okay, moving on. Number 9 is Surrender. Once again, catching myself just listening to the song and forgetting right? about it on a live podcast.
Such a great song.
Is it something that's to me, I often get distracted. Maybe, I don't know if it's because I'm guitar player guy or just like 90s kid or whatever. The style and stuff kind of distracts me from it being a great song for me. But your Tasula, was that you that said it's such a great song? What
yes.
is it that jumps out at you?
I think this is the first distinctively Edge song.
Interesting.
I really do. Like, and that's not to say, I mean, on this album, I'm not saying the first song ever. And
yeah.
Because Electric Co would definitely qualify. But you immediately, that very first riff at the beginning, that couldn't be any other guitar player. Listen to it. You know, it's so Edge. It's so distinctively him. And then by default, distinctively you too. So I love it. And I love the line, the lyric. One of my very favorite lyrics of all time is in this song. And the city is bright. It's brighter than day tonight. Like, I've thought of that in my head in so many situations where I've been in big cities in the middle of the night and looked up at the lights and just started humming that song to myself. So I love it.
Oh, I love this song too. The only thing about this song is just there's all these depressing people in Bono's songs on this album.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's about war, you know.
Right, yeah. Right. And I it's a story song about Sadie, right? And I feel like I want to catch her. You know, like I hear this song.
She couldn't work out what it was all about.
Yeah, she could, you know. Yeah, so... But another great line that Bono repeats throughout the rest of his career, and basically is his, you know, the way he lives his life is, if I want to live, I've got to die to myself someday. So I think that's very telling about U2's future and how they just have to, every album, it seems like they throw away what they did before and just start over, and they're a brand new band. So I think that's awesome. Love it. I love it. I love the song.
Yeah, there's a couple good, and just a shout out to Kelly Eskridge too for her essay on Surrender. There was two like a song essays about Surrender. They're both wonderful. So if you haven't checked those out, they're in my Twitter feed and they're on at u2.com.
Excellent. Yeah, and the theme of surrender, of course, is here, and we all know that that has come every album and tour since then. It's just big in what they do.
The closing out our podcast, much like a U2 concert, is a song called 40.
1, 2, 3, 4.
All right, Becky, you want to take?
Yeah, so as I was saying, the first live show I ever went to was the Joshua Tree, and these guys were so great, of course, and they ended the show with 40, all of the shows at that time. And when we were leaving the arena, people sang it all the way out to the parking lot. I think it went on for a good 30 minutes, maybe longer. And I said, wow, I didn't know that they did this. And it has stuck, and that's what all the fans still want to this day. And it's nice to see them putting that back in. And they did record this in the last couple of hours they had in their studio time. One thing I wanted to add here is that they recorded this album in 3 months. It can be done.
You hear that, Yuzu?
I'm just saying, they recorded it in 3 months, and this song, to answer, I guess it's Gregsky 17. They had 2 hours the last day, and they had to do one more song. And so they sat down and said, well, what material do we have to work from? And they had this material that didn't go well together. They didn't like it, but they said, let's do it. Lily White gets on it and starts cutting out all the pieces that aren't useful. And then they sat down and recorded this. They opened up the Bible, according to Bono, found the Psalm 40, and then they laid it down, I think, at 45 minutes.
Yeah, it's the...
That's the story. It's pretty legendary if you think about it for them.
Which that's where, yeah, Bono has been quoted various ways of saying, we wrote the song in about 10 minutes, we recorded it in about 10 minutes, we mixed it about 10 minutes, and we played it then for another 10 minutes, and that's nothing to do with why it's called 40.
Right.
Right.
Which, yeah, it seems to be more of the Psalm 40, Isaiah 40 connections, maybe, if anything. But yeah, it, whether it's the biblical connection or just the emotional connection to the song and having it be a closing song, even having never been to a... I don't think to a live show where they've closed the show with it. It still is like a, for me anyways, is a thing that is, you just know is part of U2. Like that's just, you know,
yeah,
part of the legend, I guess, at this point. And so.
This one is so emotional, you know, for them, and I think for their audience. And when you hear it, you know, it's the last song, obviously, but I always get teary eyed, and it just is so emotional after usually what is a very emotional show and a great church service, if you will. And that they end with this, I just love it.
I think it took on a little extra emotion this year with the loss of, or last year with the loss of Dennis Sheehan as well.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
That was hard the first time. The first time we heard after he passed, that was very hard, but beautiful, but hard.
Yeah. And I was reading a story about Red Rocks where the weather was so bad, and usually people would sing 40. It was established pretty early on, I think, on this tour, obviously, or maybe the preview of the tour, the first time they did it. But at Red Rocks, they left the stage, and nobody was singing it. And so they were like, what's going on? But then who was it that was under the stage?
It was Dennis.
It was Dennis. That's
why
it.
I brought it up.
Thank you.
Yeah,
thank you. It was Dennis.
Yeah.
So that's why, yeah, it was so great.
They ever have like a schedule, not that I ever want this to happen, but I know it's the day will come. If they ever have like the last final show of U2 ever, they better make this the last song.
Yeah, it'll be mutiny if they don't.
Or there will be problems in the parking lot. If they
problems in the parking lot. There's another good title.
They won't be able to leave.
Yeah, exactly. Fans will just band together and encircle the arena and refuse. But yeah, and famously they, you know, when they play it live, obviously everybody's probably well aware that, but maybe U2 fan at U2, or the U2 fan in the chat room who wasn't aware of Seconds being sung by Edge. They also, Edge and Adam switch instruments and,
Oh, that's right.
Which isn't always, isn't a thing that happens very often.
I was going to say that. Yeah. Oh, well, here's the thing. One more piece. Thank you for bringing that up. In the studio, Adam had already left. So Edge did both of the guitar parts. And that's why they, that's one of the reasons I think that led to the swap.
Right. And just sort of kept up that idea of, again, it was something that's very common these days with a lot of bands where they're like 10 people play 10 different instruments on each song almost. Definitely not something U2 has done a lot of, but yeah, and for 40, they definitely make an exception and swap instruments. So, but very cool. All right. Well, we made it through our war. I don't know if anybody has any closing comments on war before we close the books and let 40 ring out.
It's just the best album ever.
Is it like,
I love it so much. It's my favorite U2 album.
Yeah.
And you know, I mean, it's in my top five of all albums of any bands, of course, but I just don't get tired of it. I mean, I do get tired of some of their other stuff. You know, people may not believe that, but it's true, but I don't get tired of this.
Yeah. How about you, Marilyn? Anything, any closing words?
It's not my favorite album, but I do agree with Tasula. I can listen to this album at any time. And especially when I'm feeling down, I put this on and it just makes me angry.
Well, that's a great thing to make yourself feel when you're down.
Well, you know, it just makes me feel like I can't be held down. You know, I just feel like, yeah, Bono, you're right. I am going to sing a new song. I'm going to change everything, you know. So, and then it ends and I go on with being down again.
I do think that it did definitely, they were at a crossroads after October. They could have gone pop or rock, and this established them as rock. So there's definitely an identity piece to it. But anyway.
Thank goodness.
Becky, how about you?
Well, for me, it was my first true U2 experience, and it has such a special place in my heart and my life when I was, you know, going from high school into college and just doing a lot of growing and learning, and there's so many good memories related to it, and I love the music, and I love the feeling of it. I don't know if it's my favorite album either, but it's very high up there, and some of the songs are my favorites.
One part of the reason why I wanted to do this and why we wanted to do this sort of album by album discussion is maybe to expose folks who, for whatever reason, haven't gone back in the archives. I guess it probably, if you're listening to a U2 podcast, you're a big enough fan that you know, would have gone back and listened to all the music and stuff. But maybe you just tend to stick to newer stuff or whatever. But to throw on an album like War Boy or whatever, and now that we've sort of dissected it a little bit more and maybe exposed some of the interesting elements of it, you'd want to re-listen again with new ears, new appreciation for what's going on in the band at the time and check it out. So we'd love to hear your comments. Of course, if you send in tweets with hashtag ask at U2, you can do that. And you can also, if you have a comment that you want to direct to individuals on this episode, maybe disagree or agree strongly with something that was said. Tasula, where can folks find you on Twitter?
To be nice to me only. Yes, at Tasula, A-T-A-S-S-O-U-L-A.
And Becky, how about you?
At B Myers, B-M-Y-E-R-S.
And Marilyn?
I'm at Miss Marilyn, M-S-M-A-R-Y-L-I-N-N.
All right. And I'm iChris on Twitter. And next up is going to be The Unforgettable Fire. And so I forget who's on the list for that one, but we'll have some other guests. This is actually kind of appropriate. We discussed how some women were involved in the War album. This is the first, aside from, I guess, myself, first.
What you're saying?
All women podcast. All women.
Christina.
So yeah.
Something you want to tell us? No.
Save it for Cleveland.
And we had guys that just desperate to be on this episode too. We were like, oh, nope, we're full.
Yeah.
Good. We got this. Thank you.
Full up.
Mm-hmm. Need any war splaining, I guess, going on.
War splaining?
So you can follow along on Twitter if you want to with @U2, ATU2 on Twitter, facebook.com/ATU2com. And like I said earlier, you can find links to things we talked about in this episode, goodstuff.fm/ATU2/37. I think that's it for this episode, and we'll talk to you next time. Thanks for listening. Bye.